The Legal Sunday, The Moral Aspect of the Question, Chapter 3. The objection to Sunday laws that they require for their defense, intellectual dishonesty in their clerical and lay advocates. So much, then, has been written with the view of discrediting Sunday laws by reference to their source. It has been shown that they represented in Europe a union of church and state, and that they represent in America the same. It has further been shown that in England and in America, the authors of such laws, as we know them, that is to say with their combined prohibition of work and play, were a detestable sect, hypocritically pretending to a peculiar moral excellence, in reality, destitute alike of common humanity and common honesty. It remains briefly to examine Sunday laws on their merits without reference to their origin, and to consider their right to exist among the enactments of an American commonwealth. We have seen that the Brownist, having abandoned the written word and gone to tradition for his idol Sunday, returns to the written word only to distort and falsify it. Having violated his own principles in the adoption of the traditional feast of Sunday, the Brownist, like all proselytes, more zealous than those born in the faith, proceeds to attach to the one tradition which he accepts a degree of importance far in excess of that attached to it by others. He takes, so to speak, all the reverence and respect which other Christians distribute among a number of anniversaries, and concentrates the whole on this one day. And for the observance of this day, and the observance of it in the peculiar and unique manner of his own devising, he contends as he contends for no other portion of human conduct. And this is inevitable. For it is just because this conception of the idle and cheerless Sunday was all their own, because it marked them off from all other Christians, and even from other Puritans, and was their great distinctive tenet, that it seemed so vital and important to the Brownists. This is the way with all sects, and is the great bane of sectarianism. In almost all cases, the points of difference are among the non-essentials of the upright life, which it is the real business of religions to induce people to lead. But strength is wasted over these non-essentials, till little is left for the battle against the real wickedness of the world, and eyes are strained in the scrutiny of these minute points till the sense of proportion is lost, and small things cannot be distinguished from large things in the conduct of men. This has been emphatically the case with the Brownists, with their idle and cheerless Sunday. There is scarcely one of their kind by whom the idea of purchasing indulgence for the rest of the week, with extraordinary self-denial on the first day, is not more or less consciously entertained. The essential immorality of this idea is as plain as the strong appeal it makes to one of the greatest weaknesses of human nature. Children, and grown people as well, find it much easier to go to church twice on Sunday and lounge away the rest of the day than to be kind and gentle, honest and truthful all the other days of the week. And when church-going and lounging on Sunday are elevated to the rank of cardinal virtues, and the Sunday church-goer and lounger is considered as justified in giving himself airs in the presence of one who is neither of these things, but was cheated in a trade on Saturday night by the Sunday church-goer and lounger, then it is natural that men will practice the easier virtue to the neglect of the more difficult one, and fondly imagine that thus they are keeping balance their accounts in the eternal books. But nonetheless is it immoral because it is natural, and nonetheless is the spirit of Brownism in this regard exerting an immoral influence over its disciples, and warping the judgment of its preachers, making of them blind leaders of the blind, disqualifying them to appreciate and to teach the relative importance of things in the world of morals. While making of idleness and cheerlessness on Sunday positive Christian virtues of the very highest importance, the Brownists have disseminated the impression that the idle and cheerless Sunday, by law established, is an institution so essential to be preserved that it must be defended at all costs. And, as it cannot be defended logically without intellectual dishonesty, they have compelled their logicians to become intellectually dishonest in its defense. Intellectual dishonesty is manifested in various ways, by making statements wholly false, as by a false presentation of facts, or by suppression of relevant facts, but above all, by the use of arguments whose soundness the debater has perhaps never considered, and to which, if sound, he himself attaches no consequence whatever. In other words, the adoption of a certain line of reasoning because the user imagines that it will influence another, when the user himself is not in the least influenced by it, and would hold the same opinion if the reasoning were altogether in the wrong direction. Though the general opinion may be otherwise, this last form of intellectual dishonesty seems to constitute the crime in the first degree, and to be more degrading and disgraceful than a mere false or perverted statement of facts. It is the game of the confidence man which repels us more than that of the burglar. But, however we may grade this crime of intellectual dishonesty, the exigencies of Brownism require that it shall be committed in every degree by the defenders of the faith. In the Union Bible Dictionary, published by the American Sunday School Union under the caption Lord's Day, there is a reference to Revelation 1, verse 10. Here, the falsehood is only insinuated, that the Lord's Day mentioned in that text is Sunday. But under the word feasts, falsehoods are explicitly stated as follows. The Sabbath, by the Jewish law, was observed on the seventh day of the week, or on Saturday. But Christ changed it to the first day of the week, which is our Sabbath day, or Lord's Day, as it is frequently called in the New Testament, that it might become a memorial of his resurrection from the dead. Now, two of these three deliberate falsehoods are, of course, apparent to any reader of the New Testament, Greek scholar or otherwise. Because anyone who knows how to read and does read the English version of the New Testament knows perfectly well that the time of the Sabbath was not changed by Christ to the first day of the week, nor to any other day whatever. Nor was the significance of the Sabbath as a memorial of the Creator's rest ever altered by Christ in order that it might become a memorial of his resurrection, or of any other event whatsoever. These two falsehoods, that the time and symbolism of the Sabbath were changed by Christ, are so patent and puerile that, historically speaking, they can do no particular harm to any but the infant classes in the Sunday schools. The insinuated falsehood first mentioned, that the Lord's Day alluded to in Revelation 1 verse 10 is Sunday, must have been perfectly well known to be a falsehood by whoever wrote and edited this work, assuming that writers and editors were as fit intellectually as they were obviously unfit morally to have anything to do with the bringing forth of a Bible dictionary. But this insinuated falsehood is still palmed off on those who are presumed not to know Greek by such apostles of New England Brownism as compiled the Union Bible Dictionary. And a bubble so persistently blown may as well be pricked here once for all. The Greek word kuros means supreme authority, and is connected with this idea, fixedness, determination, certainty. From kuros, we get kurios, originally an adjective signifying both supreme and fixed, determined, stated. Thus, at Athens, the Kyria Ecclesia, or regular, stated assembly, was distinguished from an assembly specially summoned. And the adjective is applied to days by Herodotus and others to signify fixed, appointed, arranged. By a process familiar enough in Greek, this adjective, derived from a noun, came in time to be used as a noun itself, in the sense of supreme. And so, again, in due course, this noun gave birth to an adjective of its own, Kyriakos, signifying lordly or worthy of a lord, that is, distinguished, great, glorious, magnificent, perhaps at first merely decreed, fixed, appointed, in which last sense it is quite likely that the adjective would be used in connection with the equivalent of our day, on account of the similar use of kurios. Now in all the scriptures, and in all of God's dealings with mankind, there is known but one day that can possibly meet the requirements of the Greek word used in Revelation 1, verse 10. It is the seventh day, the Sabbath of the Lord. And this does meet every requirement of the Greek word here employed. That day is declared to be the sign of supreme authority, the sign of the true and only living God, the Creator of all things. Ezekiel 20, verse 20. Exodus 31, verse 17. It is a fixed, stated, determined, appointed, regularly recurring day to be remembered and observed to the Lord. It also conveys in itself the idea of worthy of the Lord, for he not only plainly calls it my holy day, Isaiah 58, verse 13, but its very origin lies in that ineffable procedure of the Lord himself in his cessation, resting, refreshing from the creative activity, and in blessing, hallowing, and distinguishing, sanctifying, the day, which made it the Sabbath day. Genesis 2, verse 1, 3. This day which Jehovah himself so honored, which he distinguished and made so great and glorious by attaching to it his own divine character, this is the day which is indeed Lord-like, worthy of the Lord. It is impossible to conceive of any other Greek term which would have so fully expressed the divine meaning of the Sabbath of the Lord. And nothing can be more certain outside of mathematics than that the phrase in question could not have been understood as designating Sunday by the early readers of the Apocalypse. It is worth noting that this is the only instance we have in the New Testament of the use of the adjective form Kyriakos as applied to a day. It has been said that such deliberate falsehoods as that Christ altered either the time or the symbolism of the Sabbath do no harm historically, outside the infant classes in the Brownist Sunday schools. So, historically speaking, no scholar is the worse for being told the deliberate falsehood that Sunday is referred to as the day of the Lord in Revelation. But the moral injury done by printing deliberate falsehoods in a Union Bible dictionary is incalculable. Let us remember that the book concerning which these deliberate falsehoods are told is the Bible. Let us remember that the one who is thus belied is the Master. Let us remember that the book in which these deliberate falsehoods are printed pretends to be a help to the young in the understanding of the history and nature of the Christian religion, and is published and circulated by a society ostensibly engaged in the work of evangelizing the world. For, remembering these things, we shall be prepared to estimate justly the sacrifice of moral sense and self-respect which Brownism requires in those who undertake the defense of its dogma of the idle and cheerless Sunday. After a while, the children in whose hands the Union Bible Dictionary of the Brownists is put come to think for themselves and to understand the true character of these statements, and what must be in their esteem the character of the Brownists who manage the American Sunday School Union when they apply to these the principle falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus. The last mentioned form of intellectual dishonesty, that of using arguments which have no weight with the user, in other words, of pretending to favor a thing for certain reasons when we really favor it for other reasons exclusively, is thrust upon our attention very frequently of late in the discussion of the Sunday law question. The Brownists desire to maintain the idle and cheerless Sunday by law established, because it is a peculiar and distinctive dogma of their sect, and its establishment by law constitutes pro tanto a union of the Brownist Church with the state. But the fact that such a union is represented in an idle and cheerless Sunday by law established is surely, however slowly, becoming apparent to the American people. The Brownists understand this perfectly well. Hence, to save their institution of the idle and cheerless Sunday, they are of late protesting with exceeding earnestness that it is, in reality, no institution of theirs at all. A union of church and state indeed. Nothing could be farther from their thoughts. It would be un-American, and the Brownists would sooner perish than countenance or advocate anything un-American. All they want, they assure us, is the secular Sabbath. It is sanitary considerations alone that move them. It is the poor, struggling, overworked, laboring man with whose interests they are concerned. Their motives are of the earth, earthy. And in their zeal for the maintenance of the idle and cheerless Sunday by law established, there is no taint of religious impulse. It is merely an accident, you see, that the secular Sabbath they are trying to keep in the law happens to be Sunday. It is merely a factitious advantage, as a certain United States judge observed, that is enjoyed by those whose sacred day is selected by the state for recognition over those whose sacred days are unnoticed by the civil authority. There is no preference of one sort of belief over another in this distinction, they plead. The day is to be preserved for the sake of the race, which would perish from off the earth through overwork if we were to do away with the idle and cheerless Sunday by law established. In judicial construction, this secular view is embodied in the expression, "The courts must view Sunday as a holiday and not as a holy day." The utter inconsistency of this view with the history and contents of Sunday laws is shown elsewhere. What we are here concerned with is the detestable hypocrisy, the gross immorality, of the Brownists who urge it. For these are intelligent and educated men. They are, indeed, the most acute and discerning in the ranks of Brownists. As such, they have been the first to realize that the old theological defense of the idle and cheerless Sunday is no longer available, that the spirit of inquiry and investigation, which is so characteristic of our age, is exerting itself on this subject as on all others, and is unmasking the established church of Brownism which lurks behind that institution. In a word, that the ground must be shifted and a new position taken if the battle is not to be lost forever. We are therefore obliged to compliment the acuteness and discernment of these men at the expense of their moral courage and their sincerity. For no intelligent man can urge without the consciousness of intellectual dishonesty the argument that Sunday laws are either passed or enforced for the physical benefit of the poor laboring man or anybody else. No real supporter of these laws can persuade himself, even by trying to persuade others, that either he or his fellow Brownists of the past or present time care in the least for the physical benefits which may or may not result from the enforcement of the idle and cheerless Sunday. All Brownists know perfectly well that their idle and cheerless Sunday was originally established in England as a theological institution and without any reference whatever to physical considerations. That wherever it is established in the United States, the motive of its establishment is a religious motive, the stimulus of its enforcement is a religious stimulus, and no regard for social and sanitary results inspires its advocates. They know that if it were demonstrated that their idle and cheerless Sunday is a positive injury to the bodies of men and a disorganizing social influence, their zeal for the day would not in the least abate, and that they would simply regard whatever inconvenience it might entail on the individual or the body politic as a suffering for righteousness' sake. Knowing all this, are they not clearly guilty of a high and execrable degree of intellectual dishonesty when they pretend that the object of Sunday laws is the physical betterment of the race and that they are supporters of these laws for any such reason? Cato wondered how one augur could look another in the face without laughing. It is difficult to understand how any intelligent Brownist can use this secular argument for the idle and cheerless Sunday without blushing at his own insincerity. But whether the red signal flag of the blush is flown or not, the corruption exists within. The man is false to himself. He has prostituted his intelligence. He has sold his soul. He has done evil that good may come. He has undertaken to obtain, under false pretenses, the goods of idleness and cheerlessness on the first day of the week. And a soul that has once been bartered is ever thereafter in the market. A clergyman who is compelled in the defense of a dogma or tenet of his sect to be intellectually dishonest ought to resign. For nowhere does falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus, apply more absolutely than to such a case. If he once plays fast and loose with his own spirit at the dictation of tradition or convention, he will do it again at the command of interest or desire. The consciousness of his own degradation will never leave him. No second baseness will lower him any further in his own esteem. He has lost his bearings on the ocean of morals. How is he safely to steer any longer, either for himself or others? The untiring zeal and determination with which the Brownists have defended and propagated this distinctive tenet of theirs have been rewarded. Their intellectual children are everywhere. Sex differing on almost every other point connected with popular Christianity vie with each other in their insistence upon this one. On no subject of fanaticism are the victims more wild, unreasoning, and bitter. The intellectual dishonesty which Brownism demands of its followers in this regard is by no means confined to the pulpit. Men of other callings who are ordinarily above the suspicion of insincerity and who prove themselves capable of weighing other public questions with discrimination and judgment will gravely affirm that it would be impossible to maintain the social order if we should dispense with the idle and cheerless Sunday. They will prate of the secular Sabbath, the overworked laboring man, police regulations, etc., etc., being all the while perfectly aware that they are guilty of false pretenses, and are throwing a mask on this dogma of Brownism, and seeking to keep it in the statute book by imposition, and by making it appear to others that it is a certain thing and has a certain purpose, when they know that it is no such thing and has no such purpose. And that if it were any such thing, or had any such purpose, they would not care in the least either for the passage or the enforcement of a Sunday law. But now that we have spoken thus severely, yet truthfully, of intellectual dishonesty, let us add that it is with no idea of imputing this quality in any particular case. Self-deception is quite as common as the deception of other people. It is common among the wise as well as among the silly. Many a man sincerely believes that he holds to an idea or supports a cause for the reasons he gives you, when in reality he is influenced by others totally different, or perhaps by no reason at all, but only by heredity, environment, self-interest, etc. The question whether intellectual dishonesty is consciously, deliberately, willfully practiced in any particular case, like all other questions of moral responsibility, must be left to that great judge unto whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid. And there are not wanting here extenuating circumstances in the cases of both clergy and laity. The tendency of the religious system of any country, as is well known, is to identify itself with existing institutions and customs. The church, be it pagan, Mohammedan, popular Christian, or whatnot, is instinctively a conservative force. It dislikes change and seems to scent some danger to itself in every newfangled notion that comes to the front. Its preachers are of the atmosphere in which they live. Summoned to defend the thing as it is, they deem it part of their duty to defend everything as it is. This conservative work is one of the grand functions of popular religion in the world. There are those who derive the word religion from two Latin words, so as to make it mean that which holds back or restrains men. Whether the etymology be correct or not, it is an indisputable truth that just as religious scruples prevent an individual from yielding to temptation, so the influence of the perverted religious sentiment in all ages has been to restrain the community from sudden and violent alteration of its ways in general and in particular. But, as with reference to the individual, so with reference to the community, we must bear in mind that religion is not everything. Mr. Matthew Arnold rightly says that the main concern of religion is conduct, and he added that conduct is 3/4 of human life. Afterward, he admitted that the proportion was perhaps too largely stated. Be that as it may, we know that the religious sentiment or impulse is often strangely perverted to the detriment of individual character. This mainly happens from its exaggeration and its misapplication to matters with which it has no real and proper concern. Great injury is also done to communities by like means. Thus, it is good to criticize, analyze, view from every side and in every part any proposed change in the state's manner of living, its laws and institutions. And so far as the conservative force of the church in its broadest sense is exerted to compel this criticism and analysis, its work is invaluable, and its mission a grand one. But, on the other hand, this criticism and analysis of any proposed change is not merely our right, but it is our duty. Change is necessary to progress, and when any change is proposed, we wrong ourselves if we do not examine its merits carefully and fairly, and with the determination to accept or reject it according as it may finally appear to us to represent progress in a right or a wrong direction. The religious sentiment or impulse, then, is exaggerated to the detriment of the community when, as is too often the case, it seeks to brand change as wrong in itself and to block in advance the discussion of any particular change proposed and the examination of it upon its merits. An excellent illustration of this exaggerated working of the religious sentiment as a conservative force is found in the use of that pet phrase of the Brownist clergy, an American Sunday, as though a thing were necessarily good because it is American, or necessarily bad because it is European. They aim, by the use of that phrase, to excite the people's emotion in advance upon the subject, and thus to prevent them from approaching it in a calm and judicial frame of mind. They would misuse the patriotic impulse to stifle the working of clear thought, and to brand a proposed change as undesirable for the utterly irrelevant reason that it is foreign, and thus to block its consideration and discussion upon its merits. Again, besides the exaggeration of the religious sentiment or impulse in seeking to prevent us from comparing the European Sunday with our own upon the merits, there is either a misapplication of that sentiment or impulse to a matter with which it has no proper concern, or else the union of church and state, embodied in the Sunday laws, must be conceded. Failing to block the comparison of the American Sunday with the European Sunday upon the merits, the religious sentiment or impulse is invoked to affect that comparison and to bias the minds of the people in making it. If the making of it is a matter with which religious sentiment has any proper concern, then it is a religious matter. And as it is a fact beyond all honest dispute that religious sentiment is the sole concern in this whole matter, it follows that our Sunday laws are religious laws only, and therefore they embody the union of church and state.